From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fillmore.
I'm from San Jose.
I'm from the Intermission.
UCCC World.
West Oakland.
East Oakland.
Coming up, we'll talk with the American Civil Liberties Union about whether President Trump's immigration orders are legal.
We know, based on his prior statements, that this is it's not allowed under our Constitution.
Then three San Francisco high school students reflect on participating in the Women's March on Washington.
People think teenagers are lazy or irresponsible. To be honest, we know what's going on.
And we'll hear from an Iranian-American composer on overcoming trauma through making art.
Sometimes you realize that you have to take advantage of that moment and find some sort of beauty in that and meaning in that, otherwise you wouldn't be able to continue.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is next. Many of California's elected officials have been speaking out against President Trump's executive orders on immigration. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein introduced a bill this week to rescind the order limiting travel to the U.S. by some Muslims and refugees. It was blocked by Arkansas Republican Tom Cotton. While Republicans control both houses of Congress, California's delegation looks much different. In fact, according to the LA Times, 40 of the state's 53 representatives in Washington, all Democrats, have expressed their opposition to the executive order via social media or official statements. Representative Jack Speer of Hillsborough said, quote, "We already do exhaustive vetting." Representative Barbara Lee of Oakland said, quote, "This is not who we are." And Representative Mark DeSaunier of Concord called it, quote, "morally reprehensible and unconstitutional." So we wanted to dig into that statement. Is the president's executive order constitutional? So we contacted Julia Harumi Mass, a senior staff attorney with the ACLU of Northern California, who leads their work on immigration rights. KLW's Ben Trefney sat down to talk with her in studio.
With the orders that led to so many demonstrations across airports all over the weekend, what do you see as being legally allowable by executive order and not legally allowable?
So just to back up, in this executive order, he suspended all refugee settlement for the 120 days and indefinitely suspended the refugee resettlement of people from Syria. That raises serious concerns under our obligations under international human rights treaties and is just so contrary to our history as a nation.
I have some statistics on that, actually.
Let's hear them.
According to the Migration Policy Institute, the U.S. resettled almost 70,000 refugees in fiscal year 2013 and granted asylum to another 25,000 plus. And the U.S. is the world's top resettlement country for refugees. Is that correct? Because, I mean, the U.S. isn't even geographically close to a lot of other countries that are dealing with refugee situations right now.
That's my understanding as well.
But that's being reversed almost completely then.
Yes. In addition, the banning of all entries of nationals from seven majority Muslim countries for 90 days and providing that that ban may be extended to additional countries raises a lot of serious concerns. It raises concerns about religious discrimination.
Unconstitutional.
Unconstitutional religious discrimination in violation of this country's establishment clause. When he was a candidate, Donald Trump repeated several times that he wanted to have a registry of Muslims, that he wanted to ban all Muslims from entering the United States. When people called foul and said, that's religious discrimination, we don't do that, he backed up and said, oh, no, we're just going to ban people from certain countries, majority Muslim countries. But we know, based on his prior statements, that this is very connected to this anti-Muslim religious intolerance, and that's discrimination, and it's not allowed under our Constitution.
Isn't it blatantly religious discrimination to say we're going to favor Christian?
Definitely.
Migrants?
Yes, definitely. That was a particular aspect of the executive order, is that there will be an exception made for Christians from those countries where you're fleeing persecution based on your Christianity. That's an explicit exemption in the executive order, which it would be difficult to be more clear about your religious preference and discrimination.
What do you see as happening from a legal standpoint? ACLU has been filing lawsuits around the country, and The intent, though, of the administration seems relatively clear. Will they end up being able to sort out some sort of legal avenues to reach their goals? What do you see?
I see a big fight. I mean, we're going to have a lot of big fights. It's pretty clear. Donald Trump is taking extreme positions. The cabinet, you know, the folks that he's assigning to lead his administration are taking extreme positions and have taken extreme positions. We see with the first week's worth of executive orders, tremendously illegal and unconstitutional policies, or policies that can only be carried out through enforcement actions that are going to, you know, run roughshod over the Constitution. For example, trying to deport 11 million people is going to require going back to things like workplace raids and neighborhood sweeps and picking people up.
Going back to, you say, when are you referring back to?
Well, the last time we saw big neighborhood sweeps and workplace raids in California or Northern California that I recall was around 2008. But there was a strong reaction to that. The ACLU at that time got involved by filing a Freedom of Information Act request to try to find out what was going on. I remember I couldn't believe the stories I was hearing from community members. ICE agents were going into apartments in the morning after one person had left and left the door unlocked. ICE agents literally just went right in, rousted people from their beds and from their showers, and brought them together and interrogated them and demanded their papers, and then, you know, packed people up and took them into immigration custody. That was grossly unconstitutional, violated the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable searches and seizures. And we pushed back. We pushed back by bringing these practices to light and by talking with elected officials. There was a young boy, a six-year-old from the Canal District in San Rafael, who was a U.S. citizen. He was picked up with his father, and he was held in detention all day. We represented him in a damages case against ICE. And I remember at that time, there were so many school administrators speaking out because the children were just traumatized, and schools had become places where people couldn't learn because there was so much fear and despair. We're gonna fight back. We're gonna fight back against unconstitutional, abusive actions, and we're already preparing. We're gonna make sure that people know how to defend themselves, and we're gonna make sure that people know to document what's happening and to report what's happening so that we can bring those lawsuits. We can bring lawsuits to enjoin those abusive practices.
Julia Harumi Mass is an attorney with the ACLU of Northern California. She spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can hear an extended version of that conversation, including discussions of border policing and sanctuary cities, all at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. The Trump administration has threatened to withhold federal funding from sanctuary cities. That includes Oakland, San Jose, and San Francisco. Those cities limit local law enforcement and city agencies in helping enforce federal immigration laws. Yesterday, San Francisco City Attorney Dennis Herrera filed a lawsuit saying withholding that money would be illegal. At a press conference announcing the suit, Herrera said this.
The federal government can't put a financial gun to the head of local and state governments. That remains true no matter who is in charge in Washington, D.C. President Trump's executive order tries to turn city and state employees into federal immigration officers. That is unconstitutional.
So what do you think about so-called sanctuary cities? Do you support the idea, or do you think they should fully cooperate with federal authorities? Call us with your opinions at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and you may hear yourself on the air. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. We're going to step back now to the day after President Trump's inauguration. An estimated 3 million people worldwide took to the streets to participate in the Women's March. Among the marchers in Washington, D.C. were 16 students from the San Francisco Unified School District. An individual donated money to the district specifically to send young women of color to the march. Students from the district's Peer Resource Program applied to represent their schools. We asked three of the students to record some of their experiences from the march, and before and after their trip, we sat down with them. Here's what they had to say.
My name is Brianna Boteo. I'm 17 years old, and I'm a senior at Mission High School.
I'm Mariana Baines, and I'm a senior at June Jordan School for Equity.
My name is Aglo Longovi'i, and I'm a senior at Burton High School.
The moment that the teacher said it, I knew that I had to apply, just because I was paying attention to everything that's going around with this new administration, and I just felt like this was a great opportunity for me to actually do something about it.
I knew that my decision to go was important, especially for my future activism and what I want to do as I get older.
My parents are like strict parents, so they'd said no first, and then like I explained more into it, and then my mom saw it as an opportunity for me to grow as a person, so she said yeah. Because I want to be like, when I grow older, like college and stuff, I want to help out people. And like, I think being able to like be a part of something with experience, I think my experiences would help people.
I feel like since November, there's just been a lot of hate being thrown around, and it's definitely visible. Like, people could definitely feel it in the air. You could definitely see it with everything that's going on. And it's created, like, it's made people really scared. And I've seen that firsthand, because at Mission High School, there's a lot of immigrants and there's a lot of people from different backgrounds and ethnicities. And I could just see it every day, how this has made them feel. I want to be hopeful, but then, like, I want to be realistic at the same time. And the reality is that he's our president. And all the things that he's saying, maybe he's gonna pull through with them, maybe not. But if he does, we have to be prepared as a community to endure that, and to possibly, if we really unite, we can make a change. But we have to take it upon ourselves.
The rich is always gonna be the rich. And Donald Trump's presidency, the poor will stay poor. We're taking what we know and what we are proud of and working on with us. We plan to share and inspire.
This is what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like.
The march was a sea of people. It was just so packed. There was so many signs up with very empowering statements, and there was just like this amazing support.
It gave like a sense of like belonging and like making me like really want to be there, like really proud to be there.
Being there, how powerful I felt, how amazing it felt to surprise like older people, for them to just be amazed at me having a voice. Like, people think teenagers are lazy or irresponsible. To be honest, we know what's going on. We're affected by it just as much as everybody else.
It was mostly white women. I really think that our group did bring a lot of diversity.
The struggles that women of color go through for being, you know, color and not being white just makes you stronger and then makes you appreciate feminism so much. And it kind of just pushes you towards fighting for your rights more because it's something that you've already done. It like takes away that fear of fighting, you know, for your gender and for your rights as that gender, because you've already fought for your rights as a human being. I definitely feel different coming back. I think that I'm just so empowered and so motivated to do things. We're powerful. We're very powerful, and we need to believe it.
We will not go away. Welcome to your first day. We will not go away.
Those were the voices of San Francisco High School students Brianna Boteo, Mariana Baines, and Aglo Longo-VE. They reflected on their experiences at the Women's March in Washington. That piece was produced by KALW's Hannah Kingsley Ma. And a quick note to our listeners, KALW is licensed to the San Francisco Unified School District. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Contemporary classical composer Sahba Aminikya came to San Francisco as a refugee. Born and raised in Iran in the 1980s, he left as a young man to study music in Russia. Then he got his bachelor and master's of music at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. The music he composes is deeply tied to his Iranian roots. He's written pieces inspired by traditional work songs of Persian carpet weavers, or incorporating the voices of Iranian women whose singing has been stifled by religious restrictions in Iran. Sahba came into KALW's studio to talk about his music and where it comes from in this edition of Bay Area Beats.
My name is Sahba Aminikya, and I'm an Iranian-American composer based here in San Francisco. I was born and raised in Iran in the 1980s, and I moved here to the States in 2006. This piece is called Night and Fog, or Shab-o-Meh in Farsi. I wrote this piece specifically depicting what happened to me in 2012. I was going back and forth between Iran and the United States. I went back to Iran in December, and it was at the ending reign of President Ahmadinejad. And basically, I was abducted and arrested in front of my parents' house, blindfolded, handcuffed, and pushed into a car. And three people with guns basically took me on a ride. A few months before, I had an interview with American TV, Persian-speaking American TV, and that was the reason that I was getting arrested. They noticed that I was doing that, and I was now in Iran. So they arrested me, took me on a five-hour ride, basically beat me up, and they asked me many questions about where I was coming from, was supporting me, like financially, you know, was it an American spy agency or anything that has related to the U.S. intelligence. And basically, I was taken to a desert outside of Iran near the shrine of Khomeini, who's the founder of the Inqilab, ironically, and they left me there in the middle of the desert. They put a gun in my mouth and asked me if I'm a Baha'i. I should say it three times and they can kill me. So the guy started pulling the trigger in my mouth, and there was no bullet in the in the gun, and they left me there half naked and with all my clothes off and all my documents taken, and with pepper spray in my eyes and in my nose and mouth. I woke up and I had this amazing epiphanic moment. Basically, when I was seeing this blurry line of lights coming from Iran, you know, and it was so beautiful. I think it's one of those moments that you realize that you are the only one who have maybe that kind of experience, and at sometimes you realize that you have to take advantage of that moment and find some sort of beauty in that and meaning in that, otherwise you wouldn't be able to continue. They asked me to get back to Iran in 48 hours and come back, and never come back to Iran. And I've been here since, and I've written 3 pieces about that incident, you know, so that is an exorcism piece in a way. When coming to this country, I realized that this is a new culture. I have to find my own roots here. But at the same time, I realized that many of the events that happen in my life, you know, when I want to actually express them in any way here, that it would be too weird and it would be very harsh and extreme for people. And it's sometimes hard for them to absorb that sort of situation. I mean, for us living in Iran, you know, during the 80s, I'm talking about it right now, and I'm, as just part of a history, I'm telling the stories that happened to me. But we have to realize that even those times, we were very happy people living in that city, because I think it's part of the human nature that you find your own ways of surviving, and those skills, like evolutionary skills, that you can basically rely on and survive the harshest situations. My first musical memories actually go back to the 80s when I was growing up in Iran. And right after the revolution, after the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, music was entirely banned from the eyes of the public, you know, and that applies to radio, television, everywhere. After the music was actually, you know, started to get regulated, you know, under a specific ministry for culture, the only source of music on TV and radio was basically either the children programs or religious music, basically, and or revolutionary songs. You know, that was part of the political propaganda as well. Basically, the only window of hope for us, you know, for children, was to actually sit at 5 p.m. and watch this amazing TV show, you know, for an hour. It was like a collection of different kind of stories, puppets, all sort of shows for children. That was the only part of our life, you know, that we could actually listen to music that was secular and wasn't, you know, following any political agenda. And many composers and musicians those days, actually, they moved to the TV because it was state TV. You know, there were only 2 analog channels on TV. It created actually a generation of composers and artists during that era, which were obviously under pressure, you know, and it was a hard time to live. But they all basically expressed themselves inside of that tiny window of opportunity that they had, you know, in order to invest in the next generation. That's what they did, I guess. It's common in Iran, you know, to say that no matter how bad it is, you know, it might become worse. That's something that should be in the back of everyone's mind, no matter where you're living. And entering the States and realizing that certainly culturally, you know, we're very different, you know, coming from different backgrounds and different stories, but Iran and United States, I think we're very close in many ways. I think the fact that we're experiencing the same human emotions, the same human processes that we were, for example, experiencing 4 years ago when Ahmadinejad was in power, you know, and he was a populist and he came in power exactly the way that President Trump did. For me, it's an amazingly educating experience to see that the same loop, the same process, and the same flow exists in every single country. I'm the artist in residence for the Kronos Festival 2017. The festival is basically consists of 6 concerts, and we are proud to say that every single piece on this festival is either arranged or composed by an immigrant or a son or a daughter of an immigrant. We didn't plan this to be this way, and it was just a moment for us to actually celebrate our diversity. And I was writing most of the pieces while the election process was going on. And what's happening right now is that many of the people who were working for the festival are actually directly affected by this executive ban, illegal ban on U.S. green card holders, you know, and people with valid visas. This puts a lot of people in a position of limbo, and What we are trying to say here, and especially the sacred music piece, it's actually a collaboration between San Francisco Girls Chorus, Kronos Quartet, and a school in Afghanistan. At the time, you know, we were only working on this beautiful collaboration between these three groups, and we wanted to bring those voices from Afghanistan here. But now it has a very different meaning. I think by bringing those voices here, we are actually, in a way, teaching our own citizens and our own people around us, you know, that how to survive this situation and how to survive this totalitarian period. We planned something that we thought it would be interesting and beautiful and effective, but it became something that is, I think I look at it now as a live being. You know, it's part of the narrative that's going around us.
That was Iranian-American composer Sahba Aminikia. He's composer in residence for the Kronos Quartet's Kronos Festival here and now at the San Francisco Jazz Center this weekend. To find out more, head to kalw.org and click Cross Currents. Cross Currents team includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Jürgen Klemm, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Jeremy Jew, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Judy Silber, Carrie Spivak, Stephen Short, and Andrew Stelzer. The show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.